Today on our Tech for Business podcast, we're joined by Todd, our COO and CISO, and Nate, our Director of Cybersecurity, to talk about the recent SonicWall vulnerability. Obviously, recording this August 8th, there may be more information coming out when you hear this, so please be aware that that is the date in which we are recording this. So Nate, what happened from your point of view? Where are we now?
Yeah, so August 8th, we're recording on a Friday. Everyone learned about this Monday morning. So August 4th, I believe that is. So CIT, we first learned about this, unfortunately, on the far end of the outcome of this, was we had a company call in looking for assistance because they had ransomware, right? And then we, as part of any incident response engagement, we try and find what is the root cause of it, so that way we can prevent kind of a reinfection as you start rebuilding the environment. I'm sure we'll do a nice incident response podcast coming up, so stay tuned for that one. But the root cause of this situation was we see access from the VPN moving into their network, right? So we were focused on that. And then as we were focusing on that, there was multiple articles on Monday, kind of mid-morning into the afternoon, that came out saying SonicWall VPNs for their SSL VPN was affected, and that there had been close to 40 organizations that had all reported having some type of security incident, right? And that everyone had thought that this is a new SonicWall, what they call zero-day vulnerability. Zero-day vulnerabilities, for those that aren't up to speed quite yet, is that it isn't even known by the vendor yet, so there's no patching available or anything like that. Multiple articles came out from trusted security professionals that are monitoring these customers' environments saying, we see malicious activity and it all stems from the SonicWall today. So then SonicWall issued guidance out that said, basically, the initial recommendation is if you don't need the VPN, turn it off. If you absolutely need it, start doing IP whitelisting, which means only trusted individuals or, you know, locations can connect in. Don't keep it wide open for anyone to access it. And then they said, you know, turn on multi-factor. But then there's a disclaimer in there that said there's been reports that multi-factor might not even be enough because it could be what they consider a authentication bypass vulnerability, right? You may be able to move around it. So on face value, everything aligned with the common behavior of a new zero-day vulnerability. With that, I'm trying to take a look at when SonicWall pushed out the additional. So it wasn't until over 2 days later, so we are recording on the 8th, it was on the 6th, that SonicWall said, we have high degree of confidence that it's not a new zero-day vulnerability. It's actually linked to a previous brute-forcing vulnerability, and that you can kind of chain multiple vulnerabilities together to exploit the VPN and still get around it. So not as bad as what we initially thought, but you still likely have a lot of SonicWalls out there that are maybe not on the latest firmware version or anything like that. So that's kind of where we're at, right? And I'm sure we'll get into the moving forward, what do you do and all that type of stuff. But that is the high level recap of everything that happened.
I'm hoping maybe, Todd, could you talk a little bit about, if I'm not affected by this, why should I still listen to this podcast today?
Yeah, great question. I mean, it does align really well with a lot of the other things I was going to add on to it. The real answer to that question is because what you should be doing about your SonicWall or others, if somebody else is using another tool, Fortinet, Palo Alto, doesn't really matter, any tools that are providing the VPN connectivity, you're still looking at the similar types of issues, although not this one specific for this week, the problems still exist. And if I look a little bit broader, and even if you're not using VPN connectivities, some of the core things that you need to be doing on a regular basis is updating your devices. So as Nate mentioned, one of the things that they come out of the guidance from SonicWall is that you should be applying firmwares. And where I'm coming from here is there's a lot of information coming at people on a regular basis. It's, hey, there's a new firmware update. There's a new update from Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera. And where firewalls and VPNs in particular are differentiated from a Microsoft patch is it's not getting pied for you automatically. You do have to physically go do something about it. And I while we're specifically talking about a SonicWall and in particular VPNs, this does apply to firewalls in general. I don't know of an organization that does not have some sort of firewall in place. But the reason why a lot of people don't ignore or don't apply them is, like I said, there's a ton of information coming at them on a regular basis. So frequently, that's overwhelming. But you also have to plan downtime for your firewall updates. And so they end up being core issues of what's going on. So to answer your question directly, why does it still matter? Is because this applies to basically everybody. And it may not be VPN specific, but the firewall vulnerabilities are. The one thing I will say about VPNs and the reason why we were concerned about it being a 0 day is they are actively being attacked every single day. We've mentioned it on several podcasts. It's one of our biggest concerns that's going on in the world at the moment. And while Nate said this wasn't a 0 day, by the nature of the term 0 day, and he kind of gave you the overview of what that definition was, it's certainly possible there is a vulnerability like that now, when we just don't know it yet. So while it wasn't attacked this week, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah. No vendor is immune to those types of exploits, right? You take a look at the WatchGuards, the FortiGates, the Palo Altos, the SonicWalls, the Meraki's, they've all had similar issues. So, and I guess the one thing that I'd chime in on that Todd had mentioned is you have to bring it down to keep it secure, right? Is that is usually the egress point of all your internet traffic in your business. And so when you have to plan that downtime, all internet stops. You might have like a pair where one can fail over to the other one to help prevent that. Not everyone has that. You've heard me talk on previous podcasts about my favorite security tools are the ones that make life easier for people, right? As a security professional, we often have the persona of being the people that say, no, turn things off, lock things down. That's not the intent. So when we're talking about like VPNs, right, is if you have to bring down your entire network to keep it operational and secure, that's not a great solution, right? That's why CIT, we've talked so heavily over the last year or so about moving to some type of zero trust network access solution or ZTNA solution. We can dive into that a little bit deeper, but you have to move away from those, the traditional perimeter-based firewalls. They just don't keep up with the modern threats. And that's nothing new. Tech changes, right? Is back 2018, everyone had remote desktop wide open to the public internet. We never had big ransomware cases. All of a sudden, threat actors focus their access on remote desktop. And all of a sudden, you start to see everyone put it behind the VPNs. And then you saw the VPNs being abused. So we put multi-factor on it. And now it's just the continuation of the cat and mouse game of who can get in.
I was almost certain when you were going down that path, the first thing you were going to say was your favorite is the device that's turned off. So I'm glad you touched on it briefly. You'd mentioned it. I think it's worth talking about VPNs, right? They're old technology. And I've said this before. If you listen to the podcast, you've heard me say this. I implemented my first VPN in the 90s. So it's that kind of age. And when you're talking about technology, that's really freaking old. And Nate kind of touched on this, and he said, is it a modern a type of approach to security? He highlighted it incredibly well. If you look at how much the world's changed from 2018 today, it's significant. And because it's changed so dramatically, even in that short period, that old legacy technology really has not kept up with the times. And as I mentioned, it's clearly just being abused. And the reason why it's getting abused, it's easy to abuse. And the bad guys, they're going to go after whatever's easy. And it is a bit of a cat and a mouse game. But what I want to highlight is we did this a couple of years ago. We transitioned from your traditional antivirus to endpoint detection response. And we were just banging on the wall and screaming at the top of our lungs, now's the time, you can't wait anymore. It feels like we're at that next tipping point, and it's, and unfortunately, it's VPNs. You can't wait. If you're not planning for it, you better get it in your budget. It is time to replace that darn thing. So, like I said, I don't want to go down this fear, uncertainty, and doubt path, but I do feel like if I'm not saying it out loud, I'm not doing justice to what the security world is trying to address. And so I do feel like we've hit that point again where it's time.
I have to kind of like chime in on one thing that I thought was really funny recently. So for anyone, there's a website called Reddit. I think it's the third most used website in the world at this point. But there's a specific community called MSP. It's where other IT providers like CIT can talk about anything IT related and how we support our customers. Last year, SonicWall had a zero-day vulnerability, and it was very, very similar to the same situation that we're talking about today. And it was really funny because I remember mentioning, I want to get rid of VPNs, and we're moving our customers towards these ZTNA, Zero Trust Network Access solutions, and I want to get rid of VPNs altogether. And 1 year ago, a lot of IT providers completely disagreed with that. Said, you know, it feels like a normal VPN. It's like, yeah, it feels like it, but the risk is, you know, transference is completely different, or the risk mitigation is completely different. With this incident, you go to that same community and there's a whole bunch of conversation of, yeah, we need to get rid of traditional VPNs. And so now you actually see all these IT providers, you know, getting in line. And it's not just the security people with their tinfoil hat. It is, you have the broader IT saying, yeah, now's the time. So 1 year ago, people completely disagreed with me, and times have changed.
Yeah. I want to highlight it. I had mentioned it very specifically, now is the time. One of the biggest reasons why people are a little slower to adopt new technology is cost, and they didn't budget for it. The cost for ZTNA is not significant. Most VPN licensing, and I'm generalizing, so bear with me as I say this, most VPN licensing tends to be $6 per user that are connecting to it. ZTNA tools tend to be in a $10 range. So while there is a delta that is more expensive, it's not significant. Most organizations don't have 300 people connecting through a VPN connection. So you can typically plan quick wins and start to get forward on it. So if you don't have it planned, start planning, get it in a budget. You should be planning at worst case, in my opinion, as soon as your next budget cycle allows you to. But if you can jam it in, again, the cost is not significant. I would jam it in as soon as you reasonably can.
We have a lot of resources out there already about actual practical steps to take directly in context of this SonicWall vulnerability. We will link all of the things below so you can see all of their updates, all of the information coming from Huntress as well. So can we talk a little bit about maybe some technical details of like an incident or ransomware? Nate, I know you've kind of experienced this before. What does, as a cybersecurity professional, what does that look like? How does it come downstream? What are those indicators that you're seeing if it happened?
Yeah. Unfortunately, usually the first indication to a company that they have a compromise is the ransomware, right? Is someone is actively in the environment and they got hit with ransomware and things are now encrypted. The reason why is that when a threat actor gets into your environment, they're not just logging right into the screen and the screens are changing, right? That's very NCIS, you know, the feeling, right? Is everything is command line on the back end, right? And so they just kind of like lay dormant and they're kind of like working in the shadows to a degree. And then all of their command line tools, then when they're ready, they say, yeah, let's execute this ransomware. And then things kick off. And that's when employees actually see files getting locked. So the Huntress article is actually really great. They do a great job documenting the findings of what the ransomware was looking like and the activity. So there is a group called Akira. It is a ransomware group threat actor. We always give threat actors names. You can imagine these. This isn't just the person with the hat, you know, or the black sweater. When you get to these big threat actor groups, treat them like another business, right? Think of something like, I'm not going to go pick on other big company names because I don't want to make them seem like they're malicious, but I'll pick on CAT, right? We're not malicious, but CAT is a business. You think of Akira like a business as well. They have customer success. They have sales reps are actively trying to recruit new people to join their group. They have payment processors, all this type of stuff. So as Akira is getting into the VPNs, what they are doing is they typically will drop new tools to scan the environment. So typically, there's a lot of different IP scanners out there. In this case, they were using Advanced IP Scanner. It's a free network scanner. They use a lot of built-in tools directly within Microsoft. And so this is what we call living off the land attacks, right? Is the tools that you need are there, right? Let me just use those ones. I don't need to drop new software into the environment. And so they were going through and using living off the land attacks, maybe dropping a couple more third-party things, dropping WinRAR to be able to pull files and share files around, FileZilla, which is an FTP kind of like sharing client for file transfers. Again, Akira typically gets in, they pull files off your network for later extortion. FTP is widely used by IT providers or, you know, IT administrators. So these are tools that likely will make it through your, you know, traditional EDR solutions, antivirus solutions, because they're well-trusted tools. They're not just crafting, you know, a super malicious file and dropping it on the network that's instantly going to get blocked. That's not the intent. Then they got in and were creating new user accounts or using existing ones and rotating the passwords. In the ransomware instance that we were working on earlier this week, sure enough, there was an existing account. They compromised it due to a bad password, and then they started using that. Then what they do is they typically will go target your what they call VSS snapshots. These are the kind of local backup copies that are done on like Windows devices. And at that point, what they're trying to do is find any of those backups, delete them. So that way, when they do encrypt it, you can't just restore from them as well. They will often look for other backup solutions on your network. So if you have a Synology, a Veeam, you know, anything like that, that they can actively get into and try and delete those backups as well. And they're trying to get to the point where they cause as much impact and pain when it comes to actually doing the restores. We see that frequently. So key thing, a whole nother topic, immutable backups. You have to make sure that they cannot be touched, right? There's a 3-2-1 rule about how many copies, where is it stored, at least one that's offsite. And then once they got in there, then they start, you know, they've got in, they've compromised accounts, they've set up reverse shells, you know, in the environment to maintain persistence, even if you start trying to do the cleanup, they've deleted all your backups. And then at this point, they're like, I think we're ready, right? Let's start the show. And then they kick off their scripts across the network to actually start encrypting files. And then that's where employees will start to see, says, you know, usually there's a README file that says, hey, you've been encrypted. We're Akira or another threat group. You know, we have all your data. We're going to extort you. You know, act with urgency. We will leak it. Here's the leak site. Quick disclosure, don't go to that leak site. Keep that for your insurance and ransomware negotiations. They also track access to that site. So if your employees are getting in there and, oh, I'm curious, you will see in the ransomware chats saying, I see you joined the chat 5 times and you haven't responded back to us. Now we're just pissed off and we're going to be less willing to negotiate with you. Or your timeline was 2 weeks. Now it's 1 week, right? A lot of technical details.
Yeah, I was going to say it obviously depends, but how long before you really think someone notices, basically, or you start getting that, you know, communication?
Yeah, I, you know, again, typically threat actors, they're, unless there's a good reason like espionage that they want to hang around in an network, they don't usually stick around that long, right? The reason why is they have a job to do, right? The faster they work, the more efficient they are, the more money they make. And so in a lot of cases, I have seen companies get ransomed from the initial time that the, you know, let's say a VPN was compromised to the time they have full ransomware. 4 hours is, you know, not unrealistic. There's been other studies out there that some of the fastest groups will get full admin compromise in an environment under 2 hours. In the case of this week, the alerts started coming in at 5:30 p.m. on a Sunday night, and by 7 a.m. is when the ransomware kicked.
Mm-hmm.
There was 150 alerts of, you know, activity before that, but they weren't monitoring their alerts. They didn't have anyone looking at the alerts overnight on a Sunday. And so had they probably could have shut it down ahead of time before something critical happened. But that was just over 12 hours before they had full ransomware.
Yeah, obviously it does depend to some degree on a variety of different things, size of organization, security tool sets, are people watching, et cetera. But yeah, need-nail, they, most often it's a business and they're treating it as such, quick, expedited, get our money, move on to the next thing.
If you're interested, I'll give a helpful link. Ransomware.live. It's a website you can go to and you can see all the website. They basically sit here and track all the ransomware activity across all the different groups. And you can see the companies that are out there getting compromised. I hope your company, you know, doesn't show up on that list, but we do see it. You know, here we're in that kind of Midwest region. And unfortunately, sometimes the companies that call into us looking for assistance, I see their name on that list.
We've talked a lot about proactive steps that you can take. I mean, we've said it over and over in this podcast and other podcasts. Next week, talk about incident response. So I was thinking maybe, Todd, you could give us a little bit of a teaser about the importance of incident response and maybe a couple things we can expect to talk about next week during that podcast.
Sure. Yeah. So incident response, we at CIT are huge believers in it. The concept is, I will use the analogy of, it's like practice. If you don't have a plan when an incident happens, you don't know what to do. If you don't know what to do, everybody's kind of running around like chickens, you know, or toddlers on the soccer field. Maybe that's a better analogy. You don't know what you're going to do. If you don't know what you're going to do, it makes everything be a lot less interesting and it makes it harder to recover. And so what the idea of incident response is it typically starts with a plan, and the plan can be pretty generic early. So as an example, things that you would do is build a call list. And what does that call list looks like? Who needs to be informed? Who needs to be pulled in to do response, et cetera. As you get better at it, we usually pair that with what we refer to as a tabletop exercise, which is a scenario of, hey, this happened, what are you going to do? And the real intent of that is to refine that incident response plan. Like, can I find it? Does everybody know where it is? And then as you go through that and further detail, you have the ability to get better and better. So you can get your plan to be more refined to specific types of incidents and so forth. But really what that involves is, more often than not, most organizations need additional assistance. And so as you're building your plans, you'll start saying, who are my trusted partners? When do I talk to insurance? Do I have a legal team that helps with communications? All those types of things. But again, we will dive deep into that at the next podcast.
And the way that I'd probably phrase it is, this should be like a core component of, people just know what to do when the incident happens. I will tell you, from all my incident response engagements over the years, very, very, very few people have a well-defined incident response playbook. Mm-hmm. It's usually those that do put in a lot of the security controls. And so there might be a little bit of a sway there a little bit, but those that have been impacted, they didn't know what to do, right? Mm-hmm. They just called in looking for assistance, and maybe they're down for a significant amount of time because they didn't know which servers were important in their environment, right? All that type of stuff. Treat it like a fire drill. right? You know, I've got young kids who in like daycare, they're already doing fire drills, right? This is a core component of just being safe. Treat it like that for your business. Is you hope you never need to use it, right? I've personally never had to execute on a fire drill that was real, right? I know what to do, right? I get out of the building and get to the grass. Everyone knows that. Who do you call? I'm not going to say Ghostbusters, but...
That's great. Oh, goodness. Well, I want to make sure that we covered everything you feel like you want to cover in this podcast. Is there anything else you want to touch on? Any proactive steps you want to share before we close out today?
Yeah, I one thing I'll add on it is I kind of pivoted this from what do you do about this particular vulnerability. As Ariel mentioned, we will provide that. There is pretty good communications in the updates from SonicWall specifically on what the next steps are. They're pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of dissemination of additional information that you need or translation, if you will. So that does exist. I mean, again, it's pretty straightforward stuff like reset your VPN user passwords, apply patching, that type of stuff. So for the most part, I think we covered it pretty well, but I just wanted to make sure that people knew, hey, well, what if this happened? I just listened to a half an hour of What Now. We do have the What Now for you as well.
And for those that did are still nervous about it, continue to look at those GTNA solutions. I can't yell it from the mountain loud enough.
Agreed.
Yes. I mean, hopefully it's not like your VPN story, Nate, where a year later people are finally coming to, but I guess time will tell.
Oh, yeah. Goodness. We do see a lot of customers transitioning, which is the encouraging thing, right? You know, year ago, it was very, very difficult to educate people to move. You know, with multiple rounds of scares, it becomes easier and easier and easier, you know, but yeah, people don't usually feel the need until there is some type of cause. I think we're starting to feel that. Unfortunately, the ones that move the quickest are the ones that usually have a incident, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, hopefully those listening to this will take this as their sign rather than an incident that you should be looking into these things, and I'll include resources for ZTNA as well.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this topic, please let us know. Like, subscribe, or reach out to us at info@cit-net.com or head out to our website, cit-net.com/podcast. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode.